I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and this week kicks off Black History Month. This time last year, we met an amazing young woman named Veronica Clay. She's a poet and spoken word performer who was a college senior at the time, just 20 years old. And if you do the math on that real quick, you will realize that means she finished high school at 16. But that's not originally what caught my attention. Veronica caught my attention at last year's Martin Luther King Day celebration at the American Jazz Museum with a poem she performed called Dear White Police Officer. Let's listen back to a conversation about the poem now.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So you said during the performance that you don't normally give preambles before you perform a piece, but you made an exception, and I'd like you to make that same exception now, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah.
So you began by establishing who you are and how you identify racially and how that's shaped your attitude toward race, what race relations can and should be. Can you share that same information with our listeners?
Absolutely. So I am biracial. My father is African-American and my mother is white. And so I have this very interesting experience of being two races at the same time. But that's something that's not a normal experience, I guess, or not very common experience because of how few biracial people are in America. And so that's shaped my perspective on what the world should look like because I have grown up in this home that's so full of love and acceptance, and the color of skin is irrelevant to the worth of a human being. And so my lens has been one of love and compassion for people regardless of the color of their skin. And so racial division itself is sort of the antithesis of what I believe the world should look like.
You performed this poem, and I want to go ahead and let you perform it before we talk about it. Can you give us your rendition of your original work, which you debuted at this event, Dear White Police Officer?
Sure. Dear White Police Officer, at my local gas station, I apologize. Mama and Daddy always told me to shake police officers' hands and thank them for their service, and I used to, faithfully. I wanted to be just like you, even had the Dollar Tree dress-up kit as a kid, black baton, cuffs, a gun, and a badge. I played in the basement with my brother, told him to put his hands up and placed him under arrest. I did my best impression of you, the good guy. But I couldn't quite shake your hand today. Dear white police officer, clocking cars on 435 South, I apologize, but something changed. I was in seventh grade, and Daddy gave me the talk his daddy gave him. He told me that when the time came, I had to drive extra safe, find a place in the open to keep my wallet, always say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, keep my hands still on the wheel and never resist, even if I did nothing wrong, because it's not worth getting killed, and I have the right to a phone call in jail. And Daddy promised he'd always find me. Dear white police officer, at the academy down the street, don't worry. My daddy didn't teach me to be afraid of you. The news did. You see, my granddaddy grew up during the civil rights, but I grew up during the Ferguson, Baltimore, and Charlotte riots. And I watched the TV screens filled with scenes of burning buildings, cars, and screaming masses, breathing tear gas. The news taught me the term police brutality and that there was a divide between black and blue lives, and that mine didn't matter, even if I was a good kid who planned to go to college. Dear white police officer, eyeing me at the grocery store, Michael Brown is the first name I carried with me, my generation's Emmett Till, with a twist, teaching me that the moment I commit a crime, I lose my rights, and that I shouldn't give officers ammunition to shoot me with. Dear white police officer, whom I was too scared to ask for help from when I was being followed at the mall, Philando Castile was the first human I saw seconds from death. His white tee was soaked red in the blood drawn by the bullets of your acquitted fellow officer. I was 17. Dear white police officer who helped me cross the street, the first feeling I felt when Mama told me Daddy got pulled over a few days ago was relief because he wasn't dead. Dear white police officer who ticketed Daddy's car in our driveway for blocking the sidewalk, but didn't ticket our neighbors, I have a childhood best friend. with a gorgeous smile and beautiful dark skin. He's gone away to college in California, and I'm afraid he won't come back because he's young and good and sometimes reckless, and I can't breathe when I think of what could happen if he gets pulled over by police and cops in attitude. My body freezes, a void opening in the cavity where my heart should be beating at the idea of losing him to you, the good guy. Dear white police officer who knocked on our front door in the dark of night to give us a piece of mail and enough adrenaline to run a mile, my brother brought home a pellet gun today, and Mama, Daddy, and I got mad. We didn't mean to hurt his feelings, but we had to remind him that he isn't like the other neighborhood kids who play with guns in their backyards, because having a black father with dreads makes bystanders question his innocence. Dear white police officer who drove me to the hospital, I am sorry if I looked at you fearfully in my delirium when I demanded my brown-skinned friend be allowed to ride with us. I knew you were just doing your job, but I didn't feel safe and didn't trust my shaking hands.
There's so much to ask you about, Veronica Clay. How did you feel performing that at the Martin Luther King celebration?
I felt a mix of emotions. I felt a little bit of fear, just because whenever you bring up such a difficult topic, there's a lot of backlash. And I think our country is so used to people fighting over issues instead of dialoguing over issues that I was a little afraid that people might want to argue.
Start fighting.
Yeah. And I was like, I don't want to fight. I'm not here to do that. So I was a little bit afraid. But at the same time, I felt also free because I was getting to express my emotions and my feelings in a way that I was hoping would open up conversation and not arguments, but just conversation, and that I could maybe be able to relate to people and start a dialogue that might be productive for our country.
You did want to be a police officer as a child?
Yeah, I did, actually. We had this set. It was from the Dollar Tree, but it was really impactful to be able to grow up and see police officers, because they were my heroes. And even I went to like this training a few years ago, like self-defense, and I actually got an application given to me. They're like, you're great, we would love it. And I was like, I'm actually only 16, but I was excited. And I was like, yeah, you guys are really cool, and I would love to be able to defend the country in the way you do. But at the same time, they're heroes that I don't think I could be because of how difficult some of their decisions are that they have to make.
It's interesting to me that so much of the content of this poem is explaining the pain that you have felt seeing the interactions between specific white police officers, but then I guess a sort of succession of them and the violence that black people have experienced at their hands. It is interesting that that's framed within an apology for your own discomfort with people who may be very different from those police officers. Mm-hmm. It's the apology piece of it is really interesting to me.
I think the apology piece is pertinent. Whenever you're talking about such a sensitive issue, to go into it with a humble spirit. And part of the reason I'm apologetic is because I am truly sorry that my relationship with the police isn't what it used to be. It's not that I hate them or that I dislike them, but I'm sorry that I am oftentimes afraid of them. I wish it wasn't that way. It's like, I wish I wasn't afraid of you. I'm sorry. Like, I don't want it to be that way. And I think that's pertinent to have that apologetic tone, because if you're really wanting to change something, it's usually because you don't like the way it is. And I'm sorry that I don't like it the way it is.
You know, you said that you wanted to start conversation, and something that obviously as a member of the media, I kind of latched onto is that you said, I'm sorry it wasn't my dad who taught me racial division, it was the news.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, the events themselves that you've seen on the news have changed your perspective in some ways? Do you think that the news could have presented those stories differently in a way that would have left you with something else?
Absolutely. So there are a lot of problems, I think, with the way racial division is talked about and discussed in the news. Part of it is like the common showing a mugshot of a person regardless of if that mugshot has anything to do with the situation at hand. That is specifically for African Americans, is that a lot of times a mugshot will be shown instead of just a regular photo, even if that crime was years ago and had nothing to do with it. So there's that. And then there is this tendency to call things riots before I think they get to a point of being rioting, so protests, and you just say, oh, well, it's a whole bunch of African Americans who are angry, so therefore it must be a riot, even if nothing has happened to make it anything more than a protest. So I think the language and the images that we associate with African Americans whenever they are frustrated are crucial, because that's what America is looking at. And you're going to get into the stereotype of the angry Black woman or the angry Black man if you're not asking yourself, am I being neutral on this position, or do I have like a subconscious bias? And am I seeing these people through a different light because of histories of seeing people that way, you know, or am I giving them a clean slate and saying, okay, this is what's happening in the moment, you know?
When you talk about your friend who's gone to California and gone to college, and that you can't breathe when you think about what he might do if he were pulled over by a police officer, can you talk about that and your choice of the phrase, I can't breathe?
I didn't expect this question because it's really personal, but it's a good question. Basically, I grew up with him, and he was one of my best friends, and maybe he was a little bit more the more wild one of the two of us, but I think it's this idea of feeling like I'm suffocating because I'm so scared, and I'm like, and I think that feeling isn't so much now as when I was growing up and I started seeing these riots on TV, and I started seeing these terrible things happening. I was just afraid for him, you know, just because when you love someone, you don't want anything bad to happen to them. So I think that was huge for me.
Well, our time is up, but Veronica Clay, thank you so much. And I'm going to keep an eye out for your work. I was really impressed.
Thank you.
Veronica Clay is a young poet who performed Dear White Police Officer at a Martin Luther King Day celebration at the American Jazz Museum last year. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from the author of a brand new book about premature birth. Stay with us. Premature birth is something we don't talk a lot about because it's unsettling in a lot of ways, but it has become more common for babies to be born early in the U.S., and if you step inside the world of the NICU, that is the neonatal intensive care unit where the most vulnerable of these babies and their parents spend up to months at a time, there is a particular kind of human drama unfolding that those of us on the outside don't fully get. But Sarah DiGregorio has written a book about premature birth and its wide-ranging implications to try and change that. It's called Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. It's based on in-depth research and personal experience. The author's in town for a handful of events, including a reading at the library tonight, and we're going to talk to her now on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Gina. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to talk about your experience, which you write about so beautifully and so relatably, but as I mentioned, you also write about the bigger questions that premature birth raises. I wonder if you can start by telling us what those questions are.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there are a couple things that some big questions that I was hoping to meditate on in the book. One of them is more celebratory. One of my big questions was, how can a baby like my daughter, who was born at 28 weeks and 1 pound 13 ounces, how have we gotten to a point where babies like her are overwhelmingly likely to survive and do well? So I really wanted to answer that question for myself and sort of color in the blanks of how that has happened and what it has all meant, and the questions that it has raised. And then another big question I had was from a public health point of view. When I found out how high the United States' rate of preterm birth is, I felt on the one hand less alone, but on the other hand, it made me feel much worse because we do have a very high and rising rate of premature birth in the United States. And when you sort of delve into that, it does reveal some real injustices and cruelties embedded in our society about, you know, who gets good care and who has a chance at a healthy pregnancy. And so those were sort of two of the big questions that I wanted to get into.
There's also this more like bioethical question about what is life?
Yeah, And when does it begin? And, you know, this was brought home to me in a really personal way. When my daughter was born, she didn't cry. She was intubated and put on a ventilator. And to me, it really didn't feel like a birth. To me, it felt like sort of some kind of a technological event where my body and her body were both very powerless to sort of to have any impact on what was happening to her. And so we were dependent upon technology and the skill of the doctors.
We're going to come back to that scene, but you do start your book with a warning that it might be a hard book for some people to read. It's basically a trigger warning, but the way you phrase it is you sort of name the categories of people who might struggle with this book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I felt like for pregnant people, you know, I don't want pregnant people to read this book and feel worried that this is going to happen to them. At the same time, I do think that it's important that in the context of an OB visit or a midwife visit, that premature birth should maybe be more a part of the conversation. But I don't want this book to be a source of anxiety for people. And so if a pregnant woman is feeling anxious about outcomes, I would suggest waiting and reading this later after you have a healthy full-term baby. And also, I think people whose babies are in the NICU right now, there's a section of the book that's about palliative comfort care for babies who do unfortunately pass away. And I think I would have found that very hard to read when my daughter was in the NICU.
Anxiety. So you've kind of hinted at that pregnant women shouldn't read this. That's partly because anxiety is a really huge aspect of pregnancy. It's got to be universal or close to it. You had to deal with an extra several helpings of anxiety for several reasons. One being that you had this appointment at around the 10-week mark.
Right. And I guess I would go back and say it's not so much that I don't think pregnant women should read it or can handle it, but I just want to give a caution that if you are feeling if you're having, you know, if you feel like this could be triggering to you, that it, you know, you might want to be cautious of that. Yes, and I think that the appointment that we had at 10 weeks, what it told us was that I had a very, very, very low rate of something called PAPA, which is a protein that the placenta is supposed to make. So in a healthy pregnancy, you would have a certain level of this protein. We had, it was, I think it was in the second percentile, so it was very, very low. And what that meant was that we were at a higher risk of placental problems. And of course, the placenta is the organ that's responsible for the care and feeding of the, for, I should say, for the feeding and the oxygenation of the fetus in the womb. And so, a problem with the placenta can be very bad. So, one thing that was my experience was that I had read some medical literature about what having low PAPA could mean. And it was all associations. It's not a causation. You know, many people who have low PAPA do go on to have healthy full-term pregnancies. At the same time,
and that's what doctors kept telling you.
Yes. And I could see, though, that it was not good that I had this very, very low level of PAPA. But doctors kept saying, you know, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. And I think that to some level that that is something that happens to a lot of pregnant women. It's a little bit infantilizing. It's like worrying is bad for the baby. So, you know, just don't worry about it.
Which means that then you're worrying about
more.
The fact that you're worrying.
Right, exactly. And I think the fact that you feel that maybe some information is being withheld from you or you're sort of like struggling to get information is also not a calming way to feel.
And yet you do not want to dive totally into Google.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. And that is why I think it's so important that my suggestion would be that OBs and midwives find a way to take the time to really address these questions with women, because you don't want them trying to interpret the medical literature all day long or going down a rabbit hole of pregnancy boards. And I think that It's something that I wish we had had more time to just discuss and to even just to have the fear validate. Like, you're right, this is associated with some things.
There is a beautiful description about how you felt about the prospect of becoming a mom, And I want to read it real quick. You write about how giddy you were. And then you write, I knew quite well that love inevitably meant more vulnerability and sadness, too. But I wanted to be brave enough for all of it, brave enough to be someone's mother.
Yeah, my mother died when I was in college, and she and I were very close. And I think for a long time I didn't want to have a baby because of that, because I felt like I had finally gotten to this point in my life where I was not grieving and I was not afraid. And I knew that having a child could activate those things again. But I wanted to have that relationship.
Even with the sort of connection to another person, which has all of that messiness to it.
Yeah, yeah. And I knew on some level that it would be worth it. I think a lot of parents feel that way.
I like the idea, though, that you associate motherhood with bravery.
Yeah. Well, my mother was very brave, and I do think of, having the person that you love most in the world and having your job be to give them the tools to walk away from you, that is your job as a mother. I find that brave. I find it difficult.
And you write about with the early birth experience that you have to confront at such an early stage this impossibility of protecting your child from suffering.
Yeah.
That you have to confront that before the pregnancy has even gone to term.
Yeah. It was a real – I really did think of it as sort of a crash course in letting go because, even I think in a routine pregnancy, there are things that you think about like, I'm going to breastfeed my child, or you have a certain plan for the birth and you have a certain plan for, how you are going to embark on this journey of being a parent. When you give birth early, it is all out of your hands. I mean, in the most literal sense, you can't even pick up your baby without, asking for permission or having it be the right time, or, you can't feed your baby. There are these very fundamental things that you just have to let go of. I did. I found it to be sort of a preview of what I think a lot of parents go through, which is this. You have to realize that none of this is in your control.
Yeah, I'm not driving this ship.
Yeah, I'm not driving this ship, exactly.
You went to an appointment at 28 weeks thinking your baby had grown. Your baby had not grown and had, in fact, fallen below the 1 percentile for size. And you entered this kind of gaming on statistics for your baby's survival. So for the best possible outcome, she needed to stay in your body as long as possible, but not so long that she would still be in there when your placenta completely stopped working.
Right, right, right.
That's crazy.
Right, right. It was, I remember the moment where I realized that that's what we were doing, and I almost couldn't even verbalize it. I thought to myself, okay, so we're going to leave her in because it's important for her to, it's good for her health to be in, but we're going to walk a line where we're trying to get her out before she actually is stillborn, before the placenta just stops working. That was very difficult. I mean, it's funny because in some ways she made it easy for me, which was very it was very weird, but for my entire pregnancy I really didn't feel her moving very much. And so we were at the hospital and they sent us home. They said, okay, go home, but you need to be on bed rest and you need to count kicks. So you need to be sure that she's moving. And if she's not moving, you need to come back right away. And so, okay.
How could you even sleep? I mean, I could not just sit there counting kicks, preparing for some inevitable but unpredictable moment when I would be thrust into an emergency delivery.
Right. I had like a spreadsheet on how many kicks I had had. She really did make it easy for me. There was just I woke up 2 days later. She wasn't moving. It was very obvious, actually. I like moved around. I drank some juice. I had a cookie, and it was just obvious. She was not moving. And so we went right back to the hospital, and she was born, maybe an hour and a half later. They just took her right out. We were very lucky.
Yeah, the details of what you experienced during all of this with like a whole squadron of medical staff on standby, these details are very intense and worth reading. I hope a lot of our listeners do read the whole story. But the main thing is, and you've kind of alluded to this, when your daughter was born, someone said, "It's a girl," and you asked, "Is she alive?" Can you talk about that?
Because when we arrived at the hospital, she was what they call it is a biophysical profile. It's a whole sort of way of measuring the health of a fetus. And her biophysical profile was, quote unquote, non-reassuring, which is non-reassuring.
Totally not reassuring.
And the other thing was that she had a heart rate, but her heart rate was completely steady, which is not normal for any of us because a heart rate always has small variables in it because it's a sign of a sign of a functioning neurological system, essentially. My impression, which I think is accurate, was that they needed to get her out right away because she was about to die. And they basically took my clothes off of me. I mean, it was just kind of like it was an experience where suddenly we were in this room. They were looking at her on the monitor, and suddenly there were like 20 people in the room. Someone was putting an IV in my arm.
If they were going to find an anesthesiologist.
Yeah, right. They didn't know if they'd be able to do an epidural. If they couldn't, they were just going to put me under. And that happens to a lot of people who give birth very early. And I knew that that they were worried that she was about to be stillborn. And so I didn't know I don't think anybody knew if, you know, what condition she was going to be born in. And I do remember saying to a nurse, I think this is in the book, if something happens to me, I could tell that it was an emergency. And so I remember saying to a nurse, if something happens to me, will you tell my husband that I love him? Because he was still getting ready outside, putting scrubs on. And she said, "Oh, honey, we're worried about your baby, not you." And I knew that, but it was very hard for me to sort of tell the difference between us. I could tell that there was a threat of death somewhere, and it was very scary.
And the whole aspect, there is an aspect of birth under, I have to imagine, any circumstances. I only have one experience with birth, so I shouldn't generalize, but it does seem like the experience of birth, there is an element of death in it, and it's kind of hard to articulate.
Yes, it is. It is hard to articulate. You're right. Because it is it's like a threshold. It's like a liminal space, right?
For everyone.
For everyone, yeah. And so whatever you believe comes before life and whatever they are about to embark on, hopefully, in life. And there's this moment where they're in the middle and neither here nor there. And yes, I think there was this sense that I had for myself and also for other people who I've spoken to who have had premature babies, this sense that it really calls into sharp relief like our questions about where are these babies? They're alive. They are sometimes, unfortunately, in the process of dying. They are before life. You know, it's a very powerful liminal moment that's very hard to articulate, as I have just struggled to articulate it.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Sarah DiGregorio about her book on premature births in the U.S., including her own story. In just a minute, we'll hear about the sideshow on Coney Island that helped make preemie care more of a thing. Stay tuned. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been talking with Sarah DiGregorio about her new book, Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. Sarah, there's a passage I would like you to read that isn't in your own writing. It's a quote you used to begin the book. It's from John Lantos, a doctor here in Kansas City. Could you go ahead and read that?
Yes, Dr. Lantos writes beautifully about this, and he is the director of the Bioethics Center here at Children's Mercy in Kansas City. And this is from his book, The Lazarus Case, Life and Death Issues in Neonatal Intensive Care. And this is an excerpt from that. The NICU, so the neonatal intensive care unit, is a strong, strange, powerful place. There is probably no eerier place in a hospital than the NICU. One enters thinking one is prepared to see tiny babies, but the babies are unimaginably tiny. They are magical. The babies seem almost but not quite human, almost but not quite fetal. In their half-human, half-machine state, they seem not only helpless and pitiful, but also exotic, threatening, futuristic, feral, untamed, barbarous. And yet these are just babies. They are real little people. And this spaceship, this high-tech roller coaster, this cyber womb is their introduction to life on Earth. I put that there because it spoke to me more than almost anything else I have ever read about the experience of being in a NICU.
Yeah, so you go from this really intense pregnancy and birth experience into this whole other realm that has just been described in that passage. The idea of it being like a spaceship is really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very strange place, I think, because it is a place of such strong contradictions. Like, on the one hand, it is so futuristic and you know, it evokes things like space, you know, spaceships and, you know, and very science fictional kinds of settings. And at the same time, they are just babies. They are, you know, and the people sitting next to the incubators are just their parents. And, you know, everyone is... there's tremendous love in the room and people really, you know, caring for other people's children. And it is also interesting to me that all of this technology, everything marshaled in this incredible way, is still not as good as a human uterus, you know? And so the contradictions inherent in that space are so interesting.
Before all of this, your career, you know, you were focused on being a food editor.
Yeah.
For Food and Wine magazine?
Yeah, I was at a couple different places when I was pregnant. I was at Food and Wine magazine, yeah.
And you started taking notes furiously in the NICU. There's something about the scene where someone working there is like, oh, mommy's taking notes. And you're like, I'm an editor.
Yeah.
But it is those notes, I imagine, that made this book possible.
Yeah. That's true. I did refer to my notes from the time. You know, I should say most of the clinicians in the NICU were not like that and were very respectful and kind and wonderful. But yeah, that, you know, that kind of thing does sometimes happen where I think there was this sense from him. He thought it was almost cute. It was kind of funny. Oh, look, mommy's taking notes. As though sort of the idea that I could understand the context or that you know, that it was important that I understand the context was kind of funny. And it did make me want to say, like, I was, you know, I'm a professional. I was a person outside of this space, and I'm still that person.
A person whose job is to try and understand.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What stands out to you now about the world of the NICU? You're this person who has researched the experience. You understand it now. But at the time, things were just happening, and it was totally new.
Yeah. I think that, do you mean my experience as it happened or how I think back on it?
How you think back on that person who was in that state of not knowing.
Yeah. I feel a lot of compassion for her. I wish I could give her a hug. But I think that I did my best to respond to things as they were happening. But I think I felt, and a lot of parents feel, things rush at you and your brain is just not taking in information the way it usually does. And one of the things that made me want to write this book was sort of an assertion of my own control over what had happened. It bothered me very much that I didn't understand so much. There was so much that I felt was confusing. And so many things kind of rushed past me that were fascinating also, especially because our NICU was an open ward. And so a lot of newer NICUs now have private rooms. ours was, you know, I'd be sitting by Mira's incubator, and I was, like, within arm's reach of three other babies from their incubators. And so I saw a lot if I sat there for 10 hours a day most days. And it brought up a lot of questions. Unfortunately, one of the babies right next to us passed away, you know, a couple weeks after we got there.
Yeah, that was one of the most painful passages to read.
So, yes, so it was just awful. And I really wanted to reassert my own sense of understanding over what had happened, and just to sort of rewrite that story for myself.
You describe how you felt when anyone in the NICU would so much as cough.
Yeah. Yes. My dominant reaction was one of anxiety about infection. And I really was, you know, if someone would cough, if I saw someone wipe their nose, if I would be, there was a room where you could pump breast milk. I mean, I would be in there with Lysol scrubbing it down as though no one else did that, you know, as though that were my job.
You needed to physically know it had happened.
Yes. Yeah. 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 I used to use the wipes. I wasn't supposed to, like the sanitizing wipes that said like medical professionals only on them. I would just go and take them. I mean, I really am usually a rule follower, but I did use those wipes every day. yes, I think one thing that occurred to me was, you know, someone says to you, well, one terrible thing that could happen to your baby is that she could die of an infection. And then, like, what's a reasonable way to respond to that? Should you wash your hands one time? Should you wash your hands until they bleed? I mean,
there's no reasonable way to respond
right.
Your baby could die if ...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was my attempt to sort of assert control over that worry. But yeah.
Something you point out is that this isn't all just over when they send you home.
Right. Right. So prematurity doesn't end at discharge. There is a very wide range of experiences. So for some babies who are born a little later, sometimes, you know, it is something that happens and then there are no long-term effects. I would say that for many, if not most parents, it's something that really lingers.
You write about PTSD for parents.
Yeah, yeah. It can really affect parents in terms of hypervigilance. You know, I think a lot of people have told me, just my friends, you know, checking to see that your baby is still breathing. But what if you've seen your baby stop breathing sort of over and over and over in the context of the NICU? What does that do to you then when you go home? And there's no more monitoring for most people. Some people do go home on some monitoring.
But you've had the experience of being accustomed to a monitor, too, that tells you how things are going.
Yes. It's very hard to let those monitors go. Yes, and that sense of fear and checking and feeling that hypervigilance, it can be very difficult. Parents often have higher rates of postpartum depression, anxiety, PTSD. And for kids, you know, premature kids are at risk for a lot of different developmental issues. I was trying to switch to breastfeeding, and we just couldn't manage it. I got a lactation consultant to come, and she said right away, she said, oh, her muscle tone is too low. She can't nurse. And I was so angry because I thought we were done with this. I thought she's supposed to be fine now. We're not supposed to have to worry about these things, you know. And it turned out that she does have something called hypotonia, which is just low muscle tone. It's a very common and very treatable minor sort of disability for premature babies, at least in many cases. In our case, it's minor. Some families have a much harder road to walk. But yes, it can affect children for their whole lives, and it's something that really is a family issue that certainly doesn't end at discharge.
You write about this question of whether your family was lucky or unlucky. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was interesting for me to think about that because, you know, we were extremely lucky. We are, I think, the overarching conclusion I have come to is how incredibly, incredibly lucky we have been. My daughter is healthy and happy. We have certain challenges that we have the resources to deal with. She was born 4 weeks after what is considered sort of the viability zone. But, you know, being born at 28 weeks and under 1,000 grams is very rare. You know, it's something like 0.5% of babies are born under 1,000 grams. 1%, I believe it's 1.6% of babies are born before 32 weeks. And so it felt like we had been struck by lightning on one hand. And it also was also very clear to me how we had escaped kind of narrowly the things that could have been much worse. And for me, I remember thinking of it as like having just escaped a tiger and having your eyes squeezed shut and just thinking like, we're so lucky, we're so lucky, we're so lucky. But actually, that's a terrifying place to be.
Preterm births, the statistics, they're going up in the United States.
Yes.
But the statistics on that don't tell the whole story.
Right.
Because in many cases, the preterm birth is better than what might have happened before all the technology we have.
Yes.
Can you talk about that paradox?
Yep. So it's interesting to talk about preterm birth statistics because that can tell you a number of different things depending on how you look at it. So a rise in preterm births can also mean a decline in stillbirths. Like for us, if we hadn't had that sort of extra monitoring, my daughter likely would have been stillborn. It can mean that there's, you know, that women are getting better care. Something like if a woman has preeclampsia, if it's identified early and you deliver the baby, then you've protected both the mother and the baby's health. And so that can mean that premature birth can be a good, can be a product of good care. So that is one way to look at it that is definitely valid.
But it can also mean that sort of systematically the care or just health and access to the factors that create good health, that is on the decline in some ways.
Right. So then the other way to look at it, and these things are not in opposition, I think they can both be true, is to look at which communities are suffering from preterm birth the most. And to know that this is something actually that a woman at the March of Dimes told me when I first started researching the book, is that the preterm birth rate can be seen as sort of a canary in the coal mine for the health of populations. And if the rate is going up for certain populations, you know that something is going wrong, and that the, you know, women giving birth in that community, their health is on the decline for some reason. It's important to look at those things. There are a number of different ways to look at that. One of them is that in the United States, Black women have a 50% higher rate of preterm birth than every other group together. And there's, you know, there's a lot of very complex research around that, but much of the research suggests that the driver of that disparity is from psychosocial stress around the experience of racial discrimination in its many forms. So when I say racial discrimination, it can mean lots of different things. It can mean implicit or explicit bias in medical care. It can mean living in a redlined neighborhood where you've experienced mortgage discrimination. It can mean living closer to a source of pollution. You know, all of these sort of like really upstream things or an interpersonal thing. So there's a lot of really fascinating research about that right now.
There is so much history in this book about how all of this has evolved over time. And we don't have time to get into all of it, but I do want to bring up this really weird part where you found out that in the early 20th century, there was a sideshow act at Coney Island.
Yes.
Where people came and gawked at premature babies in incubators.
Yes.
Talk about that and explain what that shows about kind of where we're coming from on this.
Right. When the incubator was invented, it was immediately understood by the people who were working with it that A, it worked, it saved babies, and B, it was really expensive to do. And in the sense that it required a lot of nursing care, around-the-clock nursing care. And so the workaround for that at the time was, well, why don't we put it in a storefront or in a World's Fair and charge admission for people to come and look at this incredible thing, and that will pay for the care. So that idea originated in Europe with the invention of the incubator and then was brought here by a guy named Martin Cooney, who actually was posing as a physician, but it later emerged that he was not a physician. He tried to get the medical establishment interested in incubators. He was actually very interested in trying to make it more mainstream. He couldn't make that happen for a number of reasons. One reason was that because it was expensive, but also because there was still this sense that premature babies weren't worth saving, that they were weaklings, they weren't really meant to be here. Why are we going to do this for these medically fragile?
Reminds me of Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, yeah.
Wilbur.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, in the absence of having a place to in a hospital to provide this care, he built a clinic on the Coney Island boardwalk in this amusement arcade called Luna Park. And he ran it for 40 years. I mean, it was truly a clinic. He treated something like 8,000 babies and 6,500 of them survived. And he also charged admission, 25 cents to come and to look at the babies. And he would give these really lovely sort of monologues about them. He would say, you know, maybe the future president is inside. And that was actually a very radical thing to say about a premature baby at the time. I find his sense of hope and optimism about premature babies to be very beautiful. But I do think I was wondering, you know, how could a baby in an incubator compete with something like a wild animal arena or like a sword swallower? And it did occur to me that, you know, this is a way that we react to premature babies with this sort of mixture of like horror and awe and hope and tenderness. And there is this sense that you're seeing something you're not supposed to see, which is like a magic show or like a sideshow, that there's this really powerful undercurrent to how we've always seen premature babies.
The title of your book is Early, An Intimate History of Premature Birth and What It Teaches Us About Being Human. What do you think it does teach us about being human?
That is a good question. So my sense is that I found that when I looked into premature birth, it revealed to me some very intense beauty about the way that some people have dedicated their lives to the children of others, that will go so far for a single human life, and the way that some pioneers in the field didn't give up. And because of that, we have hundreds of thousands of people alive today, this real beauty. But also it reveals cruelty embedded in our society about, you know, who can access good care, who has a chance at a healthy pregnancy. And then also it showed me a lot of uncertainty in the ways that we kind of muddle through and do our best, even when we're not sure what the right answer is. And so I think taken all together, to me, those things are ways that prematurity is a lens into a lot of really deep things about people.
Sarah DeGregorio, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to you, Gina. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Sarah will be talking about her book at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. She'll be chatting with John Lantos, director of the Bioethics Center at Children's Mercy Hospital. The program starts at 6:30. And if you missed part of the conversation we just had with her on the radio, you can go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, what's this crazy story about the University of Missouri tracking student attendance by following where students are on their cell phones? Some insights into the ethical questions there tomorrow at 10. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.